Am I correct in assuming that we're in the lunch today?
Yeah.
Good.
When this breaks up. Well, let's get underway, shall we? We'll begin with Ted Chamberlain this morning, and then we'll turn to Alma Yupiksun, Kim Gottschalk, Daley Stambo, and Alfred Starr. And we were expecting Browning Pipestem after that. He can't come this week, but he is coming next week. So his presence next week will perhaps offer a kind of transition between this discussion of what are essentially lower 48 perceptions and experiences and international perceptions and experiences next week. We have an hour-long documentary on the Navajo Nation that we will show sometime this afternoon, if that's agreeable. At a time if discussion is flagging at all, it hasn't thus far, but it may. So maybe we could begin then with Ted Chamberlain. Ted, would you proceed?
I'll just start right in. I have a few things to say that I hope will be of some help to the Commission in its review of ANCSA. I'm presenting it obviously from the perspective of someone working outside Alaska and outside the United States, but within the broad framework of native land claims in North America. I think Tim Colder is right in emphasizing that at least the Pan-American character of the situation Native people find themselves in, but my ignorance gets the better of me when I get outside of Canada and the United States. I should add that I've been one of those who been very skeptical of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act as a model for land claim settlements for Native people in Canada, mainly because in the Canadian situation at least, I think that land claim settlements hold promise for the future only if they constitute a beginning rather than an end. And it has been all too easy, for outsiders at least, to see ANCSA as representing a tidily packaged end of the story, a final legislated settlement of an awkward and somewhat anomalous claim for compensation, a closing of the file. This review commission contradicts that, of course, which is one of the reasons it's so important, and not just for people in Alaska. I think the need for the review is urgent, not only because 1991 is coming soon, though obviously that's of prime importance. As an example, in November, I was in Inuvik giving some testimony to the Canadian government's Beaufort Sea Environmental Assessment Review Panel on the effect of the proposed hydrocarbon development on native land claims across the north of Canada. During the hearings, the proponents of the oil and gas project, Esso, Dome, and Gulf, brought in someone to speak about the Alaskan experience. He presented, on the whole, a very cheerful picture of native and non-native Alaskans happy with their new prosperity and welcoming more industrial development. During the question period that followed his presentation, I asked him whether all was as promising as he had indicated, and why some of the native communities in Alaska were concerned about what the future held in store for them. I was interrupted by the chairman of the environmental assessment panel, who instructed the person giving testimony not to answer my question and told me to sit down and shut up, since these were matters that he deemed irrelevant to the panel, which at that moment, according to its schedule, was supposed to be considering socioeconomic impact. It's a silly move and a silly situation, but I think it's indicative, for it's a small part of a much larger pattern in which every effort is being made to reduce native claims to questions of land and money, and to reduce native claimants to supplicants. Things are changing, at least in some jurisdictions, but not enough, and perhaps not quickly enough. ANCSA is such a prominent part of the recent history of land claims that this review has a particularly important role to play in focusing attention on some of the crucial issues. I realize that many of these are urgent community issues that need practical attention, and the devising of new institutional structures congenial with community priorities. And I want to speak to that in a general way, and specifically about a dilemma that seemed to me to arise out of yesterday's discussion. I'm going to begin with the question of sovereignty raised by Mr. Naranja and the limitations of the statement that to be sovereign is to have authority over the land. It is not so, as Tito Naranjo said. And it is not so, not only for the reasons outlined by Professor Lerner, but for other reasons, reasons that will continue to complicate any simple resolution of land claims issues. For one thing, there is the sense, as Gloria Brennan said, that native people belong to the land more than the other way around. In those same set of hearings in Inuvik, one of the Dene who was giving testimony asked the panel in really quite startling terms whether anyone was listening to what the earth was saying. It was a striking kind of comment, consistent with some of the points that were made yesterday, and reinforces for me the limitations of any notion of having any simple measure of sovereignty or authority over the land when the relationship is of that sort. Also, of course, there's the profound religious attachments which bind Native people to the land. Whether they are actually living on it at one particular time or not, And that, I think, is an important point. I'm just going to quote very briefly from a report that's just come out. In fact, I'm not sure it's released yet, by Mr. Justice Toohey in Australia. It's called 7 Years On, and it's his report 7 years after the passing of the Aboriginal Land Rights in the Northern Territories.
Excuse me, let me spell Toohey for the record. T-O-O-H-E-Y. Forgive me.
He's talking about the Land Rights Act and the provision for community living areas and some of the limitations on the Act, and quotes from the Central Land Council's report about the need to define particular areas to which would be living areas within large agricultural leases. Even with excision, even with the defining of these areas, there will be important sites and hunting areas and favorite camping places not included in the excised areas. There will be old men who now live on the former government reserves and around Alice Springs who would like to sit down for a year or two at places in their country where they grew up. Mr. Justice Toohey then moves to take that comment very seriously indeed and to recommend provision in a revised act that would allow for that return to those places which weren't specifically inhabited. And I mention that because I think that one needs to extend, where possible, the notion of attachment to land beyond residency on the land. Extending the notion to include those whole series of values involved in that attachment, which are spiritual and not specifically material, though they're often located in property rights, and which are inconsistent with any simple notion that one can exercise any easy form of sovereignty over that land, since the powers residing in that land are not subject to such temporal sovereignty. Now, these aren't small matters. They may seem to be irrelevant to the practicalities of negotiating new arrangements or redefining or defining the possibilities within ANCSA, but it seems to me they're important because of that dilemma that faces many Native people, which is the dilemma of how to use structures, legal in particular, which aren't specifically indigenous, in order to protect indigenous values and indigenous rights. And here I'm going to move just away from land claims just for a minute and then immediately back to them. There's a Northern Irish poet by the name of Seamus Heaney who, as with a lot of poets writing in colonial or post-colonial situations, finds himself in a similar sort of predicament. He has a language which is not his to use in order to celebrate the things which are his. The language is English. The things which are his are the places to which he's strongly attached. And Heaney talks at various points about the tension between what he calls territorial piety and imperial power. The power resides in the language, which is for him the English language, a language of considerable oppression, a language which is alien, a language which is inconsistent with the values of the land. And yet the only language, the only instrument he has at his disposal. And somehow he has to find a way of accommodating within that language what he calls the piety which attaches him to his land, to his homeland, to his place, to his inheritance. These two, that territorial piety and imperial power, or plenary power, or the power of the law, however one wants to read that. They aren't easily reconciled, but they must be made to coincide, to come together, because that power, whether it resides in language or the law, is a necessary condition for maintaining that territorial piety, just as it's a necessary condition for Seamus Heaney in celebrating his land and his inheritance, or it's a necessary condition for a West Indian poet or for an African poet writing out of an English literary inheritance. And I think the analogy is fairly close, since Alaskan natives, as natives in the lower 48, belong, as Professor Lerner has said, within an American inheritance, which has value to them, and which they want to be able to use in order to protect those other sets of values to which they're committed. The poets obviously try through that language to generate images, ways of celebrating their attachment to the land. Native people have been trying with laws, in a sense, to get beyond laws to a protection for property rights and liberty, to use the language of the Northwest Ordinance. It's not easy to reconcile the two. That, and again I'll use Heaney's words here, that piety, as he calls it, involves in some measure a surrender to the rhythms of life and of nature, a kind of humility, a relaxed and almost casual attachment to the land and to its mysteries, a sense of place in which a place and the place and the community are combined. The power, on the other hand, which resides in the language or the law, insists on a self-conscious independence of the rhythms of life and nature, an intense exercise of authority, individual or corporate, a commitment, and this is one of the most difficult things, a commitment to a certain kind of clarity of expression, whether that clarity is expressed in legislation or in plans or in programs, which isn't always easily suited to the indefiniteness of the land or of the attachment to the land or of the sense of community or of the spiritual values that are part of all of those. The only way that I can see and that I think history shows of making these two coincide is by somehow generating a view of the future, which I'll call a vision of the future, just for want of a better word, in terms that are indigenous, that come from the people themselves and from their land, rather than from the legislators, the lawyers, or the advisors, though the legislators, the lawyers, and the advisors, in whatever order, can be used to give shape to that vision. That vision has to be informed by the imaginations of the people in the communities, and by their desires, both material desires for a better way of life and spiritual desires for a stronger attachment to the land and to their tribes or to their communities, by the dreaming, if you want, to use a notion that certainly the Australian Aborigines would find congenial, the dreaming of health and happiness, of peace and prosperity, as well as a number of other things. By the dreaming, by the imaginations, by the desires of those to whom it really matters, the native people themselves. It must come from the communities. It must come from that attachment to the land. And I use the word visions deliberately. Visions are not impractical. Visions are what make things happen. Visions of a free republic, or visions of a garden blooming in the wilderness, that was the vision that dispossessed the Indians of Oklahoma, or visions of pipelines across the tundra, Those are all visions, and they need to be matched, it seems to me, by their own kind of vision, a vision of their own kind of development. It may be industrial, it may be governmental, it may be whatever. But the key thing is that it be their own, and that it inform the language and the laws and the institutions and the institutional structures that flow from it. That, it seems to me, is the only way in which the native people of Alaska are going to, in the long run, make things happen rather than simply letting them happen. It's the only way, to use Tim Coulter's description, to avoid making decisions on someone else's terms, under legal duress, as it were, under the broad framework of duress that he was describing yesterday. It's the only way to establish a pattern of relationships between individuals and the natural world, between individuals and their communities, and between those communities and the larger group, and to incorporate these relationships in institutional structures, whether they're political or economic or social. That's why I think ANCSA and this review are so important for all Native people, and indeed for all people. They provide an opportunity to do this, to transform the principles, the anxieties, and the aspirations of the Native people of Alaska from the late 1960s into terms appropriate to and generated by the Native people themselves. I think I'll stop there. I have some other things that in a sense follow from that, but perhaps I can leave those for now and close with those comments, which, as I said at the beginning, may seem of an extraordinarily general nature, but seem to me to be specific to the particular need of Alaska Natives right now to find a way of turning ANCSA to their own advantage, of transforming it or reshaping it or whatever into an instrument for their own future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. Any observations or questions arising out of Ted Chamberlain's remarks? David Case?
Well, yeah, thank you. I have some questions, but they, he's touched on some questions that I think have come up throughout this, the first couple of days here. I don't know that it's necessary to go into them right now, but I think we have to go into them at some point. I would certainly like to ask at some point, or have Mr. Jim and Mr. Naranjo and Ada Deer and Tim give us your thoughts on the degree to which, or the necessity you have found to use Western institutions for your own purposes. And I've heard you discuss your experiences that seem to raise this question. I don't know now if now is the time to go into this or not, but I think we should go into it.
Well, that seems to arise out of what Ted Chamberlain was saying. So carry on, if you wish, to Tim Coulter, you're on the verge of something.
Yes, I was very pleased to hear you suggest that it may not be necessary, in fact, may not be advisable at all, to take hold of and use models for development, models for organization developed by others. I know I'm not saying it really the way you did, but and that applies as well to models for activity. It's not, of course, necessary to rely alone on the processes of the law, the processes of Western political interaction, even. And in fact, Indian people, indigenous people in many places have been quite successful in resisting that type of approach and insisting upon and managing to hang on to some of their rights and interests by deliberately staying out of the courts. I, for years, represented, in fact still do, a community of Mohawk people that took over several thousand acres in the Adirondacks in New York State, their original homeland that they'd never given up. And they just kept it, and they held off the state police for years with weapons, managed to convince practically everybody that they were sincere and had a just cause, and they're still there. And they have a thriving and successful community living peacefully with their neighbors, and they never had to go to court. In fact, they were sued, millions of efforts, well, dozens of efforts were made to get them into court, none of them successful. And they have done extremely well by using their own model for asserting and defending their rights and by avoiding the what they felt was a very serious trap. And there are many kinds of practical approaches that might be useful and valuable here. And I know I'm expanding very much on ideas that you only mentioned, but it did spark something that I thought was something that had been left out entirely yesterday and that needs to be mentioned and talked about.
That's sort of what I'd like to go into. I mean, what are, avoidance, either by force of arms or the demeanor on your face or otherwise, it certainly seems to be one tactic Ada Deer has asked, I think suggested that the one thing that Native people share is the desire to remain Natives. Native Americans. Professor Lerner asked, what is an Indian? And I'm not sure if that's the point you were making in that question, but I hear the same issue. What does it take to remain an Indian? And I think this is, I guess, what I see as being summed up, and I'm not sure it is, but in the idea of self-determination. The ability to determine yourself and who you or we, the concept applies to any human being, I suppose, or any group, community of people, potentially. So my question is, what are some other strategies in the experience of Native communities that have been used or tried to maintain or to remain Native, and how well have they worked? And maybe that's enough. I have some specific things in mind, but maybe I just should let it go now for the moment. And
you might let us have those specific items because I had one or two myself.
The strategies that have come to my mind over the last few years are, I think, two, and then Mr. Naranjo suggested, I think, a third. And I think just that last second, Tim Coulter suggested another. So I'm less than convinced I've got all of the categories here. But control of economic resources has often been characterized or seen as essential to self-determination for Native people. And I think that's particularly the focus of the Claims Act, to the extent that it may be self-determination sort of legislation. Another strategy seems to be that of political control, what I hesitate to call sovereignty, and so won't, but at least the ability to govern one's self. Now, I'm not sure that means governing land in the sense of controlling land in a way that is offensive to Native Americans, but at least controlling social relations among a community of people. political control of some kind. And I separate that from ownership of property in the Western sense. And of course, this is a Western mind, you know, categorizing things. But I think that political control, I'd be interested to know to what extent political control is viewed as important, necessary, or whatever, to achieving self-determination. And then Mr. Naranjo seemed to me to suggest that it was one strategy to remain native was to maintain a sense of cultural integrity, for lack of a better term, it's not his term, but that the Pueblos have persisted over a long period of time because of, and forgive me if I'm wrong, I mean, and misinterpreting you, but because they have a sense of community and a very cohesive religious philosophical base that has been able to essentially, I think, co-opt other institutions to their own view. But that cultural, that sense of who we are, who they are, has been important, maybe all that's necessary. If there was no economic resources, no electricity in Taos Pueblo, it is simply sufficient to have a sense of who one is, who you are. But I'm interested to know, what institutions, are there institutions that are necessary to do that, or can it be done without institutions? And another strategy, I suppose, is isolation, keeping apart. And that can be physical isolation, as is possible in a lot of Alaska. It can be political isolation in some sense. It can be, in the case of the Mohawks, I suppose, some kind of demeanor or reputation that keeps people away. And so those are the things I guess I have in mind, and I'd like to explore the extent to which any of these or other strategies have been important in maintaining Native American communities and remaining Indian, in your experience.
Mr. Naranjo, do you want to respond?
Yes, I would. I think that one of the kinds of things that maybe we haven't talked about is how a people see themselves as beginning. I talked about the emergence legend, how the people came about and how the people are going to live. But the Pueblos actually do perceive an end, meaning that when we no longer are Indians and we no longer can define ourselves as a people, then we should give everything back to the river. Then it should, this life should end. This, our way of being should end. When we can no longer nourish the sun to go on its journey in the summertime and in the wintertime, then life should end. We can, when all of this web of life is no longer meaningful to people, and people, by, I guess, there were Pueblo prophets who said, there will come a time when this way, which is termed a heavy way, this life that we carry, is no longer meaningful, then we must end it. And I think I was talking with Ray Hudson this morning. Some Pueblos have done this, as a matter of fact. Pecos Pueblo in New Mexico in 1829, 1830, thereabouts, vacated the Pueblo, a reservation, a trust piece of property, moved to Pecos, moved to Jemez, excuse me, and said, this is the end. This is, the lights are out. We no longer are a people. The land reverted back to, is now a museum, and the Park Service runs it, sort of thing. So it's not that, you know, these peoples want to go on living for the sake of owning a piece of land alone. I think that they can only live in the sense that the culture defines living. At least for the Pueblos, this is the way it's defined. It may be defined other ways by coming generations of Pueblos, but for the time being, for those who carry on this tradition and this culture, they say there will come a time when the end will come, and we will return back to, again, the lake, you know, and the forms of life will continue. So there is an end, and maybe if the U.S. government waits long enough, this may happen. The other things, I guess, in terms of just membership is, the Pueblo peoples have never really had trouble with defining who they are. I think Santa Clara versus Martinez is very important because one thing was reaffirmed that people know who they are and that the people define that they are, we are we. How can anyone ask who the group is in the Pueblo sense? Because we sanction each other, because we know who influences us, we know who we interact with, we know who is a member by participation, we know who is a member by culture. His skin may be white, his hair may be part blonde, but if these things are working, these kinds of things that we identify as being a part of what we consider, for example, a Tewa, then he's a member of the group. And I think probably some, there are other facets of that, of exchange with each other within this message that we carry in our heads about who we are, that's that defines membership. And it's not by blood, it's because of the Constitution, you know. We defined it as down the father's line and one half blood, but that was forced on us. At a point in time, there was a German school teacher who lived long enough there, and they said, she is a part of us. We should give her the right to be us. And there was debate in council whether or not she was to become part of us. So there wasn't a rigid written system. When people, I think, are forced to write and to make it rigid, then this kind of cultural identity with regards to membership loses its viability, if that's, you know, according to that way. But in terms of ongoing kinds of identity, there's no problem with identity. Again, I've got to go back to a religious philosophy, and this religious philosophy that is so important, that is an umbrella over everything else. This religious philosophy that says who we are, where we came from, how we're supposed to live, that also determines government, that also determines the family, that also determines how we make money and so on, that sort of thing, is it just infuses all of life as far as Pueblos are concerned, spiritual, sacredness, whatever you want to call it, and all kinds of infringements can occur upon that. But as long as that basic structure is standing of this philosophy that people carry around in their heads, and we don't even know that we're carrying around this philosophy, except that we talk about it in terms of seeking life. We're in the process of seeking life. They say, you know, we are seeking life. And that determines that we're still in process yet. But when that process ends, whatever, you know, if ultimately all the kids decide to watch television forever, you know, and decide that seeking life is no longer meaningful, maybe then it, and whatever immense kind of other influences come and destroy this philosophy, then I think then there is no more identity.
I don't want to really get into discussing cases, forgive me, but I think we should. What would have happened, what would have been the effect on the membership interest that you mentioned, if Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez had come out the other way? In other words, the court had held that the equal protection language of the U.S. Constitution controlled the determination of Pueblo membership. Would that have had a significant negative effect, in your opinion?
Pueblo people, this thing has remained intact. I can't answer for you specifically, because some kinds of group processes go to work immediately. And these processes always take time, and that's why I am struck by what Ted Chamberlain said: a vision, and it informs the institutional structures. You know, what people develop visions as things happen of how to cope with this kinds of things. But if there's some kind of institution there to cope with that, Santa Clara either was going to subvert it and incorporate it nominally, or was going to handle it in fashions that they had handled the Indian Reorganization Act, the Spanish imposition, the going into the kiva of the sacred dances. What is really meaningful is going to be protected. But specifics, there can't be any specifics. It's only what Ted Chamberlain says, because these kinds of things, when inform the institution and the institution begins to protect and to cope, and I think it implements a process. And where this process goes is that I think it again reaffirms this philosophy that's there, to seek life, and to seek life as we know it. That's not very specific answer to the question, but yeah.
That's fine. That's your answer.
Russell, Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One comment on the Martinez. Perhaps it would not have caused a negative, well, the negative effect is dependent upon which organization you belong to. PRA, for instance. But I wish there were, I wish these questions were brought up 100 years ago. How do we preserve and protect the a people? And as of now, how do we thwart this road to eventual genocide? And it is approached in many ways. Take Western water law, for instance. The Yakimas are not an agriculturally oriented people. And yet, in Western water law, first in time, first in right, use it or lose it. And we had somewhat of abundance of water, so we says, well, how do we save our water? And 50 to 60 years ago, we put it under irrigation, put our land under irrigation. What has eventually resulted is that Fertile Valley, which is raising contemporary crops, is now devoid of much of the natural foods that were there. And it is the natural foods are an intricate tie to the culture, no different than the languages. And I appreciate also Ted Chamberlain's thoughts, wherein the laws that were given to the indigenous peoples dealt clear down to the smallest microcosm. The institutions that need to be advised from here on are perhaps the educational process. The present method is set to assimilate. As I mentioned in my first talk 2 days ago, the textbooks must be changed. The attitudes must be approached differently towards the preservation of a culture, quote unquote. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak of visions, to speak of rights, of as someone mentioned, perhaps in a flip way, a couple of days.